Invite you to take your Bibles, and we continue the lesson that we started. We talked about some of the early parts of it, and Elijah just comes on the scene. Basically, if we were talking about in terms of a gunslinger, he's got both barrels blazing as he takes down Ahab. He confronts Ahab after the 3.5 years of drought. In fact, the drought's still going on. And Ahab basically accuses Elijah of being the troublemaker. And Elijah says, no, it's you. You are the one that's causing all the problems. And to prove his point, he challenges Ahab to accept a contest. And in 1 Kings chapter 18, we're going to start at verse 19. Now then, send and gather to me all Israel at Mount Carmel, together with 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent a message among all the sons of Israel and brought the prophets together at Mount Carmel. Elijah wants to prove his point, and he does not want to do it just for Ahab, because Ahab's not the only problem. He's challenging such that he says, let all of Israel come. Let everyone see whether God is actually the God that Elijah worships. So, in verse 21, Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you hesitate between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. But the people did not answer him a word. I want you to take notice of that last phrase. Elijah basically challenges them, just like he did with Ahab. He's blunt. He says it straight out. He says, who are you following? If Baal is God, follow him. But if God is God, follow him. The problem is that the people for a long time have been trying to have it both ways. They were trying to follow the gods that they'd like to follow, Baal and the other types of gods, because that gratified things of the flesh and things that they wanted to believe, while at the same time they were trying to follow the God of Israel. In fact, in 2 Kings chapter 17, if you'll hold finger here, we're going to go to 2 Kings 17. And look at verse 33. Because this points out what had happened in Israel. They feared the Lord and served their own gods according to the custom of the nations among them, whom they had been carried away into exile. Israel, throughout this period of time, had been trying to do it both sides at the same time. They were, in a sense, trying to worship God as if he was just another one of a whole set of gods. But isn't that what people try to do today? There are a lot of people that say they are Christians, that we're following God. Oh, but I want to do this of the world. Or I want to do that of the world. At the same time. You can't do that. You can't stay with God and follow after the world and its sins. You have to pick one or the other. We're supposed to be committed to the Lord. Take a look at Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Let me get a bookmarker over here so I can flip back fairly easily. Matthew chapter 6, and we're going to read verse 24. No one can serve two masters, for either he will love the one, or hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. You're going to fail at serving one or the other. You cannot have it both ways. Most oftentimes when people try to worship the world and God at the same time, the world wins out. You just cannot do both at the same time. And what Elijah was doing was being very bold in confronting the people with their sins. He wanted them to face their choice. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, same thing that preachers have to do. And it's something that all of us as Christians have to do. There are people that are following their own desires. There's people following the world. We cannot always sugarcoat it. Sometimes is saying things gently and nicely is things that will help people out. Sometimes, though, we just need to be blunt. Because people then decide if you sugarcoat something, then it's all right to compromise. In 2 Peter chapter 4, or 2 Timothy chapter 4, starting with verse 1, I solemnly charge you in the presence of God and of Jesus, Christ Jesus, who is to judge the living and the dead, and by his appearing and his kingdom, preach the word. Be ready in season and out of season. Reprove, rebuke, exhort with great patience and instruction. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth and turn aside to myths. People want to hear what they want. Sometimes in order to break somebody out of that spell, you got to say exactly what is. I've always sometimes amazed. You can tell somebody something and they'll not hear what you say. They're hearing what they expect you to say. And sometimes you got to just be blunt about it so that they hear exactly what you do say. And that's what Elijah did. That's what John the Baptist did. And sometimes that is called for. So the challenge went out, going back to 1 Kings. That would help if I turned on the mouse, wouldn't it? First Kings chapter 18, and in verse 22. Then Elijah said to the people, I alone am left, a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Now, let them give us 2 oxen, and let them choose 1 ox for themselves, and cut it up, and place it on the wood, and put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other ox, lay it on the wood, and I will not put a fire under it. Then you will call on the name of your God, and I will call the name of the Lord. The God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people said, that's a good idea. It's a good challenge. It's not something that would happen by itself. So the challenge goes out. And we see then the results of it, starting with verse 25. So Elijah said to the prophets of Baal, choose 1 ox for yourselves and prepare it first, for you are many. And call on the name of your God, and put no fire under it. Then they took the ox, which was given to them, and they prepared it, and called on the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, O Baal, answer us. But there was no voice, and no one answered. And they leaped about the altar which they had made, and it came about at noon that Elijah mocked them, said, call out with a loud voice, for he is a god. Either he is occupied or gone aside or is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and needs to be awakened. So they cried out with a loud voice and cut themselves according to the custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out of them on them. And when midday was past, they raved until the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, but there was no voice, no one answered, no one paid attention. Sometimes it's to make a point. You have to put it bluntly. Normally we don't mock people, but in this case it was appropriate to point out how silly they were in trying to make their God listen to them. in the manner in which they were trying to do. A God that really did not exist. You know, people often go out of their way to avoid offending other people. And it's not that Christians ought to make themselves offensive. But there are times when we cannot spare the truth to spare somebody's feelings. Take a look at Matthew 15. There was a time when Christ told the Jews quite bluntly that they were in sin. And put it on the table. It was very clear. And the disciples in Matthew 15, starting with verse 12, came up to Jesus afterwards. The disciples came and said to him, "Do you not know that the Pharisees were offended when he heard that statement?" But he answered and said, "Every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be uprooted. Let them alone. They are blind guides of the blind. If a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall in the pit." Notice what he said. Don't you understand? What you just said really offended those Jews. You're driving people off. Jesus' point is they were already driven off. They already had made up their mind. Sometimes it takes direct answers to get people to see. Going back to 1 Kings chapter 18, God does answer. We get down to the time of the evening sacrifice. It says, "And Elijah said to all the people, 'Come near to me.' And so all the people came near to him, and he repaired the altar of the Lord, which had been torn down. Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Judah, to whom the word of the Lord had come, saying, 'Israel shall be your name.' So with the stones he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he made a trench around the altar, large enough to hold 2 measures of seed. Then he arranged the wood and cut the ox in pieces and laid it on the wood. And he said, 'Fill 4 pitchers with water and pour it on the burnt offering and on the wood.' And he said, 'Do it a second time.' And he did it a second time. And he said, 'Do it a third time.' And he did it a third time. The water flowed around the altar, and so he filled the trench with water. At the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice, Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, today let it be known that you are the God of Israel, and that I am your servant. I have done all these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back again. Then the fire of the Lord fell, and it consumed the burnt offering, and the wood, and the stones, and the dust, and licked up the water that was in the trench. When all the people saw it, they fell on their faces, and they said, 'The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God.'" Think about the wild antics that Baal's prophets and Asherah's prophetess all had done. Cutting themselves, pleading, dancing about. Elijah actually made his task harder. He waited until the last moment, prepared the sacrifice, had poured 12 measures of water over that sacrifice until it was just flowing. He even had a trench around it to catch that water. It's well drenched. Is there any possibility that Elijah had cheated? I mean, everybody that was there absolutely knew there's just no way that sacrifice was going to light itself. You're not going to claim, well, he had a little magnifying glass on the side and was, you know, burning a little bit of thing. There's too much water there. And what's amazing is the heat that was generated. Some people say, well, in fact, the drawing here shows the lightning flash. It's not even close to what happened. Because think about how heavy that fire had to be. It not only burnt the sacrifice, but the wood, the dust, the stones, the water, all went up in flames. That's hot fire. And the people saw it, and they acknowledged that God is God. Starting then with verse 39. It says, when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and they said, the Lord, He is God, the Lord, He is God. Then Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal. Do not let one of them escape. So they seized them and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and slew them there. That might seem a bit harsh. But these were people who were teaching false doctrine. Proven to be false. We have to understand, while we don't go off killing people, that's not our way, we still need to confront false teachers. In Titus chapter 3, Titus 3, starting with verse 10, it says, reject a factious man after the first and second warning, knowing that such a man is perverted and is sinning, being self-condemned. We don't play games with people who are trying to teach falsely. We need to be bold. We need to be willing to confront. We need to be saying that, hey, if you don't straighten out, you're out of here. We so often want to please people. But there's some people that just won't follow God. Paul said in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and starting with verse 3, 2 Corinthians 10, starting with verse 3, for although we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we're ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete. We have to understand we're sometimes at war. I had somebody write to me just last week saying, you can't use God's word as a weapon. I cited this passage and several other ones to talk about the sword of the Spirit being the Word of God. His response was basically saying, oh, you just cite passages. You're hiding behind them. He had no answer to them. He didn't start sending me slogans, and that's when I decided that was enough to talking with him. He didn't want to listen. He was upset that he had no response to what God said. And sometimes we have to do that. We have to expose sin. In Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 11. Ephesians 5 verse 11 says, do not participate in unfruitful deeds of darkness, but instead even expose them. A lot of times we have to confront evil, and rather than making somebody feel good about themselves, which is what a lot of people try to do, we ought to rather say, hey, yes, it is wrong. You ought to feel guilty about the sins that you are doing. I have a lot of people say, can come back and say, well, what do I do with, I feel so guilty about the sins I did. And I write back, good. Because that's going to keep you from doing it again. The people that don't feel guilty is the ones that worry me. They're the ones that are not concerned about doing right. Elijah confronted sin. He proved that these prophets were wrong, and he was willing to stand up for it and expose it and enforce the Old Testament law, which said that false prophets were to be killed. He wasn't taking this on himself. He was just enforcing the law that was already there. in that particular law. Now, I want you to understand, Elijah did this so that all of Israel would see. All of Israel turned. And now he goes back before Ahab. And starting with verse 41 of 2 Kings chapter 18. 2 Kings 18, starting with verse 41. Then Elijah said to Ahab, "Go up, eat and drink, for there's a sound of the roar of a heavy shower." So Ahab went up to eat and drink, but Elijah went to the top of Carmel. And he crouched down on the earth and put his face between his knees. And he said to his servant, "Go up now, look toward the sea." So he went up and looked and said, "There's nothing." He said, "Go back 7 times. And it came about at the 7th time that he said, "Behold, a cloud as small as a man's hand is coming up from the sea." And he said, "Go up and say to Ahab, prepare your chariot and go down so that the heavy shower does not stop you." In a little while, the sky grew black with clouds and wind, and there was a heavy shower. And Ahab rode and went to Jezreel. Notice that Ahab is now listening to Elijah. Elijah's fairly convinced. He's convinced even Ahab. Ahab is even listening to what he's saying. Going back to James, though. James uses this event to point out the power of prayer. James chapter 5, starting with verse 17, says, "Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And it did not rain on the earth for 3 years and 6 months. Then he prayed again, and the sky poured rain upon the earth to produce its fruits." Elijah prayed, and God answered. Both at the beginning, at Mount Carmel, and at the end, we saw Elijah praying when he raised the child. God answers prayers. A little interesting side note, Ahab was told, hurry on before you get caught in the rain, because it's going to be heavy rain. So he's running from Mount Carmel to Jezreel, which is not a short trip. And then there's this little side note that says right in verse 46, "Then the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins, and he outran Ahab to Jezreel." I think Marshall and PJ would like to run that fast. Outrun a chariot. Why is that pointed out there? Again, to show God's power. Why did Elijah do that? Or why did God have Elijah do that? Well, think about it. Ahab's in a chariot. He's running as fast as he can. He leaves Elijah behind. And when he gets to his destination, there's Elijah again. The point is, you can't escape God. Wherever you're at, Elijah's there. God's going to bring his message. But then an interesting thing happens. And sometimes people just don't understand what's going on. Because right at Carmel, that's the height of conquering. Elijah proves God in a very dramatic way that turns people's hearts. It says, "Now Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, 'So may the gods do to me and even more if I do not take your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time.'" Jezebel, of course, is not happy. She wasn't there, by the way. She didn't witness this thing. But I want you to understand that Elijah at this time, beforehand, probably was absolutely convinced that he had convinced everyone to turn back to God. And yet at the heights of what we do, sometimes that's when we're weakest and most likely to fall. Jezebel threatens him with death. And Elijah doesn't think it through. He forgets about the fact that God's taken care of him, how God's protected him for 3.5 years. He doesn't think about God's power. He doesn't recall that he stood before God. Just as one woman's threat causes him to run. It's 2 Kings 19, verse 3. And he was afraid and arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Ran all the way to southern Judah from northern Israel, which is not a short distance. Afraid for his life. Why? Because he thought he failed. He thought after all this time, when everybody was so convinced, he was faced with the reality that you can't convince everybody. In verse 4, it said, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree. And he requested for himself that he might die, and said, it is enough now, O Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers. I couldn't convince everybody. Therein lies where the problem lies. This is where the difficulty is. He was convinced he was going to be able to prove it to everyone. And he didn't get his way. It didn't work that way. Jezebel was threatening his life. A threat by one woman who God had already proved was powerless caused him to decide he was a failure. Because he didn't turn everyone as he wanted, he didn't live up to his own expectations. And notice the lie that he told himself, saying, I'm the only one left. I'm alone. Why do I call that a lie? What happened to Obadiah? What happened to the 100 prophets that Obadiah was hiding? See, Elijah's not thinking. He's not seeing reality as it really is. But I want you to notice God's answer. Starting with verse 5. He lay down and slept under a juniper tree, and behold, there was an angel touching him. And he said to him, arise, eat. Then he looked, and behold, there was at his head a bread of cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. The angel of the Lord came to him a second time and touched him and said, arise, eat, because the journey is too great for you. So he rose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mountain of God. From there he traveled down to the southern peninsula of Sinai, back to Mount Sinai, which is also known as Horeb. I want you to notice what God didn't do. He did not answer Elijah's complaint. He didn't try to make him, he didn't try to convince him, he didn't tell him he was wrong. He just said, here, you need to eat, you need to drink, you got a journey to make. 40 days. Elijah didn't get an answer. I want you to keep that in mind, because remember what Jezebel threatened? My life, if I don't take your life by tomorrow. He runs, never was killed. He's now 40 days later. He's still alive, even though he asked to be killed. He's still alive. And notice what he says to God, starting with verse 9. Then he came there to a cave and lodged there. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? He said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with a sword, and I alone am left. And they seek my life to take it away. They're going to kill me. So I'd rather you kill me. They weren't successful. But he's not thinking. So he said, go forth and stand on the mountain before the Lord. And behold, the Lord was passing by. I want to make sure I didn't miss a point I was going to make. And a great and strong wind was rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of gentle blowing. When Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in the mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, a voice came to him and said, what are you doing here, Elijah? Then he said, I have been very zealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the sons of Israel have forsaken your covenant and torn down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword, and I alone am left, and they seek my life to take it away. Do you notice what Elijah's doing? Every time he's asked, what are you doing here? He comes up with exactly the same answer. He's repeating himself. He's stuck like a broken record. He's not thinking. He's not looking and saying, they're not successful. They haven't taken my life. I'm still here. God's still there. And also think about the strangeness of his request. He wants to die. Why? Because somebody's trying to kill him. That doesn't make sense. If you're worried about somebody trying to kill you, then don't you want to live? But a lot of times when people get caught in depression, they don't think clearly. They don't see the world the way it really is. The Lord said to him, go and return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael, king over Aram, and Jehu, the son of Nisha, shall appoint king over Israel. And Elisha the son of of Abel Mahola, you shall appoint as prophet in your place, and it shall come about the one who escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall put to death, and the one who escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall put to death. Yet I leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Now notice that. Again, God doesn't really answer Elijah's complaint. He just says, hey, I got work for you to do. Get up, get moving. I want you over here. By the way, he's way down in southern Sinai. By the way, I want you to go to Damascus. That's way up north, even farther than he's been before. Far up on the north side. I want you to go appoint a king up in that country. Then I want you to go over here and you're going to pick up Elisha and appoint him. And there's another king that you're going to appoint over Israel. God's got him running all over the place doing work. And oh, by the way, you're not alone. There's 7,000 people that haven't bowed to Baal. Elijah was locked in thinking that he was alone, that he failed. And he had no answer but that he wanted to die. God's answer was basically, you're wrong, now get up and get busy. Sometimes we forget that people are people. We look at Elijah, Look how bold he was. He confronts Ahab numerous times, tells Ahab right to his face, you're wrong. He proves to the children of Israel right in front of them that God is God, has the prophets slaughtered, but he's still just a man. In 2 Corinthians, we think about the boldness of Paul and the other apostles. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, starting with verse 5, for even when we came to Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us with the coming of Titus. Notice what Paul says. Did he feel the strain of the work that he was doing? Yes. Did he have qualms? Did he have worries? Did he have fears? Yes. It's not all smooth sailing. It's not always easy. Especially for people that have to be really bold in confronting people. In a lot of ways, they're putting their own self on the line. And a lot of times they feel vulnerable. We need to keep that in mind. But you know, the solution is the same. You gotta realize that you're not alone. And that you gotta get busy. And here I've used up all my time and I haven't got done yet. So this is gonna be three parts. But I want you to think about the things that Elisha, remember what James said? Elisha was a man just as we are, with a nature like ours. We think about him as being a great hero, and he is. And a bold man, and he is. But he had weaknesses. He had struggles. He had to face hardships. And sometimes what seems to be just the smallest thing tosses him over the edge. He's no different than the rest of us. But I can offer an opportunity this day that if there's anyone here who is not yet a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here is a child of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the Lord.